Christianity more than proved its vitality by enduring waves of persecution prior to Constantine the Great. When persecution was withdrawn and the faith climbed out of the catacombs to become the darling of the state, the question was whether it would survive the corruption political power inevitably brings. While many thousands of pagans professed faith because it was the politically expedient thing to do, some sincere believers, well, they marked the concomitant moral corruption that took place and forsook society to practice a purer faith in monasteries, as we've seen in previous episodes. The institutional church, on the other hand, organized itself in a manner that resembled the old Roman imperial system. When the empire crumbled under the weight of its own corruption, that fall, of course, being accelerated by barbarian invasions, the question was, would Christianity fall with it? The story of Christianity in the West, it's a remarkable tale of survival. You know, so often in history, when a culture is swept away, so is its religion. Now, Christianity has proven an exception. As often as not, it endured when the culture changed. Such was the case in Europe and the events subsequent to the fall of Rome at the end of the 5th century. When the gospel first came to those urban centers that were the cultural heart of the empire in the late 1st and early 2nd centuries, it was pretty much regarded as a Jewish reform movement. Its first converts were Jews scattered around the empire, and those few Gentiles who'd attached themselves to Jewish synagogues. But once these God-fearing Gentiles came to faith, they evangelized their Gentile and pagan friends. Following Paul's example in speaking to the philosophers on Mars Hill, we read about that in Acts chapter 17, these Gentile Christians recast the gospel in Greco-Roman terms, using ideas and values familiar to the pagan mind. Here again, as I've said before, when I say pagan, please don't think of it as an insult, as it is in our modern vernacular. You know, someone who's void of moral virtue. By pagan, I mean those who practice the religion of the Greeks and the Romans with its pantheon of gods and goddesses. In that sense, Plato and Aristotle were pagans. Zeno, the Stoic philosopher, was a pagan. These were all men who developed the philosophical framework that shaped the worldview of Greco-Roman culture and society. They asked penetrating questions that provided the intellectual backdrop of the first and second centuries. Gentile Christians picked up these questions and used them to say that they'd found the answers in Christ. Many other pagans found these arguments convincing and were won to the faith. Some of the early church fathers even appealed to the ancient philosophers in the formal letters that they wrote to the emperors on why persecution of Christians was bad policy. They argued for a promotion of the faith as a boon to the health of the culture, not a harm to it. Their defense of the faith was couched in terms the emperors were familiar with because they shared the same philosophical language. My point here is that Christianity made an appeal to the Greco-Roman worldview it was growing in the midst of. So what would happen when that society fell? Also, the church's organizational structure increasingly came to resemble the imperial structure. What would happen when that too was dismantled? Would the faith survive? Had Christianity grown too close to the culture? Had the bathwater dissolved the baby? And the answer is yes and no. The empire's demise did pose a setback to the church. But we might ask if maybe that was good. The institutional church had in many ways deviated from its purpose and calling. Some bishops were far more concerned for their political power than for their role as spiritual shepherds. In many minds, spiritual and earthly power had merged. At the same time, Rome's fall allowed the faith to break away from the political attachments that had corrupted it for the last century and a half. But there's little doubt that from the 6th through the 9th centuries, Christianity suffered a kind of, spiritual declension. Over that 400 years, the total number of people who claimed to be Christians dropped. Fresh movements of renewal declined, and moral and spiritual vigor flagged. While there were exceptions, overall, Christianity lost ground, giving this period of time in church history the title, as Kenneth Scott Latterette calls it, the Great Recession. A series of devastating plagues ravaged the populace, killing millions from Italy to the Byzantine Empire. The plague of Justinian from 541 to 42 was one of the deadliest, depopulating the capital of Constantinople by a quarter. Such widespread death and suffering severely tested people's faith, as they questioned how a benevolent God could allow such a tragedy. Following the timeline of church history at this point, it becomes difficult because so much was going on in so many places. So for the balance of this episode, I want to give a sketch of both the many reversals and few advances that Christianity saw from the 6th through the 9th centuries. When the Goths, Visigoths, and Ostrogoths moved in to pick clean the bones of the Western Roman Empire in the 5th century, something remarkable happened. While they helped themselves to the wealth of the empire, they also adopted some Roman customs that they admired. But nothing was so surprising as their embrace of Christianity. In truth, these barbarians were already what we'd have to describe as nominally Christian. Their invasion of and settling into Roman lands greatly furthered their identification with the faith. Remember that in the ancient world, war was more than just an attempt to take land and plunder. It was a contest of faiths. The ancients believed armed conflict was a kind of spiritual tug of war. The mightiest god gave his or her people victory. This is why when one people defeated another, the loser's religion was often wiped out. But the Germanic barbarians tended to embrace Christianity rather than destroy it. There was something different in the message of Christ from their ancient folk faiths that drew and converted them. So when they took down the Roman imperial structure, they left the churches intact. Bishops continued to exercise oversight of their flocks. Unlike other religions, Christianity is supercultural. It wasn't just the faith of one group. It potentially embraced all. Even those who rejected the gospel recognized that it wasn't merely the spirituality of a specific ethnic group. Its message transcended culture to encompass all of humanity. That was the situation in the northern and northeastern borders of the empire. The situation in the south was rather different. In the 7th century, Islam swept out of Arabia to conquer the Middle East and North Africa. The Muslims managed to gain a foothold in Spain before the armies of Charles Martel stopped them from pushing any further in 732. Where Islam conquered, it replaced native religions. Now, enclaves of determined Jews and Christians did eke out an existence, but by and large, the crescent replaced the cross throughout the Middle East and North Africa. While there's no specific date or event that marked the onset of the Great Recession, we'll set the year 500 as the starting point, and here's why. In 476, Romulus Augustulus, the last Roman emperor, was deposed by the Goth leader Odoacer. Now that marked the end of the Western Roman Empire. The capital then shifted undisputedly to Constantinople in the east. It's always struck me as an odd fact of history that the name of the last official Western Roman emperor combined the names of the legendary founder of Rome and the empire's first emperor, Romulus and Augustus. Now, just 20 years later, in 496, the Frank King Clovis was baptized. That marked a new era in which Germanic rulers became the standard bearers of the faith rather than Italians. And then in 529, the Eastern Emperor Justinian closed the schools of Athens. Now, these academies were the last official symbols of Greco-Roman paganism. Justinian ordered them closed to signal the final triumph of Christianity over paganism. That same year, 529, Benedict built his monastery on Monte Cassino, as we have seen in a previous episode. The Benedictine rule was to have a huge impact on the course of the faith in the West. While Christianity seemed to stumble in so many places where it had been installed 300 and 400 years before, it continued its relentless spread into new territory. It was during the early 6th century that the faith went up the Nile, meaning south into Sudan, and in the later part of the century, Pope Gregory sent missionaries to Britain, and in the early 7th century, the gospel reached China. But the 7th century is when the Arab conquests began. And less than 20 years after Muhammad's death, Islam had raised its banner over Palestine, Syria, Mesopotamia, Persia, and Egypt. Before the end of the century, they'd conquered all of North Africa, including the capital at Carthage, and by 715, they had taken Spain. The lands Arabs conquered, well, they had a rich Christian history, especially in North Africa. Alexandria and Carthage were home to some of the most prominent Christian leaders, theologians. Athanasius, Arius, Alexander, Cyril, and Augustine, to name just a few. At the same time that Arabs were spreading Islam across Christian lands, up in the Balkan Peninsula and Greece, pagan Slavs moved in. In 680, Asians called Bulgars crossed the Danube River and set up a kingdom in what had been the eastern frontier of the empire. And between those losses to the Arabs in the south and the Slavs and Bulgars in the east, about half the total land area that had been Christian territory was now lost. The 8th century saw large numbers of Germanic tribes come to the faith, but the 9th and 10th centuries were marked by repeated invasions of pagans from the distant north. Called Vikings, these Scandinavians raided the shores of northern Europe, Britain, and all the way to Russia. They delighted in looting the many defenseless churches and monasteries that they included in their conquests. These Viking raids shattered the fragile unity that the Carolingians had pulled together in Europe. As society broke apart into minor political regions, the quality of spirituality in the churches declined. Discipline in the monasteries grew lax. Bishops focused more on secular than spiritual matters. The clergy grew corrupt, and the papacy became a political football. By the 8th century, a general crisis of religious faith had taken hold across the lands of Christendom. According to records from monasteries, church attendance and observance of practices like baptism dropped precipitously. It was common for people to simply lapse into folk mysticisms, blending pagan traditions with Christian rites. The institution of the church had less cultural capital and authority than it had before. An example of this was the cult of the angels that arose in the Aquitaine region of France during the late 8th century. Now, local peasants began worshiping a hierarchy of fallen angels, such as Uriel, Raguel, and others that are mentioned in apocryphal texts. They built shrines, made sacrifices, and essentially crafted their own folk religion, pulling from various unorthodox sources. The Eastern Church of the 8th and 9th centuries was rent by the iconoclast controversy. In the 9th century, Muslims conquered Sicily and Crete and established a beachhead in southern Italy. In China of the mid-9th century, Christianity experienced a wave of fierce persecution. This was due to the faith having been too closely identified with the previous dynasty. Now, as we come to the dawn of the 10th century, there were several positive signs that the faith was growing again in the regions where it had declined. Churches were planted among the Slavs and the Bulgars. The faith extended its reach into Russia, and there's indications that the church in India began to grow at this time. One sign of a positive spiritual turn took place in eastern France in a place called Cluny. In 910, Duke William of Aquitania founded a monastery on the Benedictine rule, but the abbots that were selected to lead it were men of tremendous character and piety. They were determined to correct the lax moral attitudes that had become all too common in monastery life. And so the Clunyac reforms not only reinvigorated monastic life, they established a new hierarchy for monasteries. Prior to Cluny, monasteries were connected to, and in a sense, answerable to, local bishops and nobility. Cluny and the monasteries that came from it were directly answerable to the Pope. This became an important element of church life when, during the 11th century, the popes tried to untie the church from secular powers. While the monastic life may seem strange and at the same time stereotypical of the romanticized view of medieval life that we have today, monasteries acted as repositories of the wisdom and learning of previous generations. As wave after wave of invaders washed over Europe and society was shattered into a thousand bits, monasteries remained cultural lighthouses. And it's from those lighthouses the first rays of dawn will come to spark the Renaissance. Christianity moved from being officially persecuted in the Roman Empire during its first couple of centuries to being the official religion of the empire in 380, when Emperor Theodosius I, also known as Theodosius the Great, declared it so in the Edict of Thessalonica. This edict made Nicene Christianity the official state religion of the Roman Empire. It stated this, quote, "We desire that all peoples embraced by the rule of our clemency shall practice that religion which the divine Peter the Apostle transmitted to the Romans. We order that all who follow this rule shall embrace the name of Catholic Christians, But for the others, since in our judgment they are foolish madmen, we decree that they shall bear the infamy of holding heretical dogmas." Unquote. So the edict outlawed pagan religions and non-Nicene Christian sects within the Roman Empire, establishing Nicene Christianity as the sole legitimate religion and granting it a privileged status. So as stated earlier, this led to many pagans making a feigned conversion. They adopted the forms of Christianity while privately remaining practicing pagans. That was especially true in urban centers of the empire. It was different in rural communities where imperial enforcement of the edict was difficult, if not impossible. There, because of the decline of genuine faith in the urban centers and the inevitable impact that it had on church leaders, people returned to the folk religions of their ancestors. This widespread spiritual declension only served to make the armies of Islam more bold in their determination to rid their lands of people that they assumed were Christians by profession, but appeared to be pagans by practice. While the political weight of the Roman Empire was a toss-up between Rome and Constantinople during the 4th and early 5th centuries, with the fall of the Western Empire in the late 5th century, the political center shifted entirely east, and the church effectively replaced the state in the West. What was left of civil authority in Italy moved to Ravenna and Milan, but the center of religious gravity remained Rome. The church didn't feel threatened there because many of the barbarians invading the West were ostensibly Christian. They may not wholly agree with Rome's doctrine, but they were of the same broad stripe. As Martin Marty writes, a pagan Rome that had at one time dominated the bodies of men was succeeded by a Christian Rome that dominated their souls as well. This new empire was at first merely ecclesiastical, but quickly merged the ecclesiastical with the political. Church and state became one. With that combination, the church determines who is saved and who's not. And so the phrase extra ecclesiam nun salus becomes common. It means outside the church, no salvation. Now, on its face, that might be said to be true, if what we mean is that all those who are saved are a part of the church as God sees it. And if that's what we mean, then sure, outside the church, there's no salvation because by the church, we mean all those who are saved. But that is not what the phrase came to mean in the Middle Ages, because what Rome meant by the church wasn't as simple as all who had been born again by faith in Jesus Christ as Lord and Savior. No, for Rome, the church was the Roman Catholic Church ruled by the popes. Obeying God meant obedience to the pope and Roman magisterium of cardinals, bishops, and priests. People's access to God was only through the agency of the church. The Pope declared who was in and who wasn't. Now, modern people might say, so what, to that, because conceptions of the afterlife are legion. Many assume that death is the entire end of existence, that there's no consciousness after one's last breath. Many more hope that even though they aren't religious, as they would say it, they're a good person, and so some kind of eternal paradise exists for them. That was not at all the attitude of people in the Middle Ages. Yes, there was the occasional atheist, but they were by far the exception that proved the rule. Everyone believed in the afterlife, and that afterlife was either in heaven or hell. Heaven was for Christians, hell for non-Christians. And to be Christian meant, for most people in the Western Empire, to be in the Roman Catholic Church, which in most places was the only game in town. The Pope declared who was and wasn't in. It can be rightly said that the Roman Catholic Church was the spiritual heir in the West of Imperial Rome, the state that had before wielded a single sword of civil authority. Now, by its churchly heir, wielded two swords, one of ecclesiastical and the other of civil authority. And all that authority came to rest in a single office, the papacy. Now, the Roman Church always knew that it needed to appear, at least, to be a step away from civil authority. Popes were not kings. But Rome never forsook the opportunity to let kings know that they only ruled by permission of the church. The church told rulers what to do, and rulers did it, because back of it all was that ecclesiastical sword of the pope saying who was and who wasn't in the church, and so either on their way to heaven or hell. In future episodes, we'll see the contest between church and state play out in some pretty dramatic moments. When speaking of the era of the fall of the Western Roman Empire and the so-called barbarians, we find them so often cast as the bad guys, while the people of the empire were the good guys who were just, you know, minding their own business when hordes of savages descended on their lands to do little more than rape, pillage, and party. And let's not forget that for the people of Central and Northern Europe, that's pretty much the way things had always been for them. Their history was a long tale of invasion and conquest. The Romans had done the same thing to the region a few centuries before. The fact is, the new invaders from the east, they didn't just come seeking loot. They planned on settling in the empire. They longed to enjoy the benefits of a civilization that they had long heard about. The Vandals came from the region that is today southern Poland. They crossed the Rhine in 407, made their way southwest across France into Spain, where they then hopped over to North Africa in 429 and took Carthage 10 years later. Once firmly in charge of all of North Africa, they launched out to take the islands of Corsica, Sardinia, and Sicily. And as we've seen, they sacked Rome in 455. Their rule was disastrous for the church, though they were ostensibly Arian Christians. They persecuted Catholics and Donatists, who were still split into separate groups. After a century, the Byzantine Emperor Justinian's famous general Belisarius defeated the Vandals, but the faith the Byzantines brought was not harmonious with the Arianism of the Vandals, nor the faith of the Donatists, nor the Catholics. When Islam swept through the region a century later, it found a patchwork of various faiths and churches that were at odds with each other. And the situation, quite frankly, hasn't changed much to this day. After the Battle of Adrianople in 378, when the Visigoths, or Western Goths as they're known, trounced the Romans, they moved southwest and settled in what today is Spain. They were eventually conquered by the Muslims in the 8th century. They also were Arians, but they took a different tack with Orthodox believers. The new Visigoth rulers realized that the people that they had just conquered were the stewards of the very civilization that they wanted to reap the benefits of. And that eventually resulted in the conversion of their king Recared at the end of the 6th century to Nicene Orthodoxy. Following Recared's example, most Visigothic nobles shed their Arianism and became Catholics. Gaul roughly corresponds to present-day France. It was divided between the still pagan Franks in the north and the Arian Burgundians in the south. Once settled into their new lands, the Burgundians shed their Arianism in favor of the Orthodox Nicene faith. And we'll tell the story of the conversion of the Franks and the dramatic impact that was to have on church and European history in a later episode.